I'm playing today for creative freedom, for dignity, for all life, and world peace.
I don't understand how they could walk into this situation and not understand the appearance of impropriety in giving a no-bid contract to a Halliburton subsidiary.
This administration doesn't just lie and engage in dangerous and illegal and immoral policies, but it believes a lot of its own rhetoric.
So Jazeera, at least, and they're in a really tough position because they have a lot of pressure from their backers and I think from the majority of their viewership to present a certain viewpoint.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, September 24th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The leader of the militant group Hamas says they will not disarm or accept a truce with Israel. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin made the announcement during his first public appearance since Israeli forces tried to kill him with an airstrike. Some fear the statement undercuts efforts by the incoming Palestinian prime minister to negotiate a ceasefire with Israel without confronting the militants. Yassin, who spoke at a mosque near his Gaza City home, also lashed out at the United States, saying President Bush, quote, declared war on Islam and that America will be defeated by Muslims. Meanwhile, a group of 27 Israeli Reserve Air Force pilots signed a petition stating that they would no longer agree to carry out airstrikes against Palestinians, calling the attacks illegal and immoral. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told Congress today that President Bush's $87 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan was an affordable and needed investment in international security. But a top Democrat questioned whether the American people have ever blessed the U.S.-led Iraqi reconstruction effort now underway. Is $87 billion a great deal of money, Rumsfeld said before the Senate Appropriations Committee? Yes, he said, but can our country afford it? The answer is also yes, because it is necessary for the security of our nation and the stability of the world. Rumsfeld cited progress in reopening Iraqi schools and hospitals and training a new Iraqi army. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin expressed concern about a contract awarded to a subsidiary of Kellogg Brown & Root, Halliburton, formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. Durbin questioned the defense secretary about the proprieties around awarding a no-bid contract to Halliburton to put out oil field fires in Iraq.
This has been a source of embarrassment to, I hope, the administration and to our country, and perhaps to those who view us from overseas. Mr. Secretary, at some point along the way, did someone step back and say, you know, we ought to think twice about a no-bid contract to a company which formerly employed the vice president? Was that a source of concern to you, that it did not appear to be on the square, and perhaps a little more thought might have been given to it?
The two issues have been raised with me. One was a Bechdel contract, and one was a Kellogg Brown and Root contract.
Halliburton contract.
And I'm sure Dove has better information than I do, but I was advised that the Halliburton contract for oil field restoration is currently in the process of being recompeted, and that no new funds are planned to be awarded under the old contract, and the Army Contracting Authority is expected to award a new recompeted contract about October 1st, in a week or so. My understanding of the contract is that originally it had been competed, and that it was a contract that was for emergency type activities of the very nature that it was used to fund in this case for a short period of time, and that that was what was done. The Bechtel contract, that was a Corps of Engineers contract. The other contract that gets raised from time to time, I'm told, and we've looked into it, is an AID contract with Bechtel that was used for infrastructure. And this contract, which does use appropriated funds to rebuild non-oil infrastructure, was not a sole source contract. Six companies were offered the request for proposals, and the award was made after evaluation of their submissions. Again, that contract, however, is going to be competed for any new work to be accomplished after the November-December time frame.
I'm happy to to learn that what we have read and heard about has led to a greater sensitivity from the Department of Defense. I don't understand how they could walk into this situation and not understand the appearance of impropriety in giving a no-bid contract to a Halliburton subsidiary, and one that had the potential, I understand, over 2 years of $7 billion being awarded to this company. But the fact that no more funds will be given to Halliburton subsidiaries until there is a competitive bid, I think, is progress, and I salute you for that change.
Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois and Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld. But Rumsfeld's denial contradicts numerous press reports that Halliburton got the contract without a competitive bid. Madea Benjamin of Global Exchange and Occupation Watch says the General Accounting Office, the Congressional Oversight Office, has taken the Army Corps of Engineers to task for awarding the no-bid contract to Halliburton. Benjamin also stated that other companies have expressed anger and a sense of hopelessness, saying that the contract was awarded to Halliburton because of its political ties to Vice President Dick Cheney. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin also expressed concerns about conflicting reports from the Bush administration on increases in combat pay and family separation allowance.
At one time, they said in the statement of administration policy they were opposed to these increases. Then they came back and said, no, we favor these increases. Now there's the third option. And the third option is to remove the increases in combat pay and the increases in family separation allowance, but to increase hardship pay only for those troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think this would be a serious mistake. How in the world can we justify activating all these guardsmen and reserves, removing them from their families, and saying, if you don't happen to be assigned to Iraq or Afghanistan, we're going to revert back to $100 a month family separation allowance?
Department of Defense Controller Dr. Zakim.
Well, it's true that we're extending the family separation and the imminent danger pay through the end of the year. At the end of the year, we go with the increase in the hardship, and that is, in fact, for Iraq and Afghanistan.
Senator Durbin.
So the increase in combat pay is eliminated, and the increase in family separation allowance is also eliminated, and instead there's an increase in hardship pay of $300 a month, but only for two theaters, Iraq and Afghanistan. We can give all the speeches we want about our respect for men and women in uniform, but I find it unconscionable that we are going to say to so many thousands who've been activated that they are not going to receive an increase in family separation allowance, that it will be eliminated. How can that help morale? How can that say that beyond our speeches, we really do care about these men and women in uniform?
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld offered this response.
My understanding is that the executive branch had an arrangement with the legislative branch that the supplemental would be restricted to Iraq and Afghanistan. It seems to me that the point that Dr. Zakheim makes really does suggest that we conform to the requirement. I could be wrong on this.
But the defense conference only funds this for 3 months. So what's going to happen, what I've just described, is going to happen, and it's an administration decision, and I think it's the wrong one, and I think you're going to hear about it.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin at the Senate Appropriations Committee earlier today.
This is Anthony Sloan, a.k.a. T, from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet, the engineer and sometimes sound gatherer for Pacifica's Peace Watch. I do hope you're being informed by our efforts here. If you find what we do valuable, please make a financial commitment to Peace Watch so we may continue our work on your behalf. Kindly make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at pacifica.org. That's pacifica.org. Or you may send us a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, care of Pacifica, 2390, that's 2390, Champlain, Champlain, Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you on the front lines. Peace.
President Bush gained one commitment today from German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder to set aside differences and work together for a strong and stable Iraq. We both agree that we want to look into the future together, Schroeder said. It is very important not just for Iraq, but for the whole of the region, for Germany, and therefore the whole of Europe. Schroeder has offered to help train Iraqi police and security forces, and the U.S. has been quick to accept. Still, there was no indication that Germany would contribute peacekeeping troops, as it has to Afghanistan, or that Schroeder would retract his support for France's call for a quick end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The U.S. is still waiting to see how the rest of the world reacts to President Bush's speech at the U.N. yesterday, calling for broader international cooperation and commitment of troops towards the post-war reconstruction of Iraq. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Francis Boyle, professor and international law expert at the University of Illinois at Champaign, as well as Stephen Zunis, associate professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. To gauge their reaction to Bush's appeal for support, Professor Zunis went so far as to prepare a line-by-line refutation of Bush's speech, so we began by asking for his initial reactions.
This administration doesn't just lie and engage in dangerous and illegal and immoral policies, but it believes a lot of its own rhetoric. It really is in a mindset that seems to be out of touch with reality and how the rest of the world sees things.
I was kind of struck by, in reading accounts this morning in the Washington Post, that President Bush was not in the actual hall or chamber when UN Secretary General Kofi Annan delivered his address, and that not only President Bush, but the entire U.S. team contingency left prior to French President Jacques Chirac's address. Were those deliberate political snubs or a diplomatic faux pas? Or what? How would you assess that?
It's hard to say. I mean, the pettiness of which the United States has challenged even allied nations and a relatively subservient Secretary General is quite remarkable. When they have raised quite legitimate issues that are fully enshrined in the UN Charter, the United States takes personal offense. So I don't know if this was a deliberate, calculated, whatever, but they've certainly done as bad or worse in the past.
Professor Boyle, what was your reaction to the president's demeanor and specifically his address?
My reaction was the reaction of just about everyone at the United Nations, that it was a brazen performance. He went in there, continued to tell all the lies that they have been telling about Iraq for the past year, and tried to bully the UN and the UN members into supporting the continued U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
When you say that it was brazen, do you think that, I mean, obviously part of the objective here was to try and win support and to get some of these nations to assign troops and money to this effort, to the reconstruction efforts in Iraq? Did he win any votes in that regard?
I don't think that was the objective. I think the objective here was, as even reported in the New York Times, was to project an image to the American people from the UN podium of leadership on Iraq, and in order to get support of the American people in Congress for what the Bush administration is doing in Iraq. Clearly, if he had genuinely been attempting to get support at the UN, this was not the way to do it, and they knew that. They knew what they were doing, and they knew they weren't going to get support because they've made it very clear they are not going to give up control of Iraq. They went over there to steal Iraq's oil. That's very clear. That's what this is all about. It's also clear President Chirac, Schroeder, the German chancellor, have indicated that they're not going to give support to what the U.S. is doing in Iraq so long as we're going to continue to assert unilateral control over that country and its oil supply.
We do know that recent opinion polls, nonpartisan Pew Research Center has found that 32% of the American people thought that Bush has a clear plan, which means the flip side of that is 68% of the American people don't think he has a clear plan for bringing the Iraq situation to a successful conclusion. Professor Zunis, do you agree with that, with what Professor Boyle has said, that it was really not about trying to get nations to sign on, but about trying to make the case to the American people?
I do think the speech was geared more towards the American public than the United Nations, for no other reason than the fact so much of what he said was misleading and downright false. And anybody who knows about the history of the United Nations relations with Iraq and the UN Charter and basic principles of international law would be able to see right through that. Most delegates of the United Nations are familiar with those things. Most Americans are not. At the same time, I'm sure he would very much like support from the international community, and the international community would like to help out in the sense that I think the entire world recognizes the importance of having Iraq become more stable, more democratic, to be able to rebuild its economy, not just for humanitarian reasons, but for stability for the world as a whole. However, they are not going to do it as part of an occupation. I think most of the international community prefer something like the situation in East Timor immediately after the Indonesian withdrawal in 2000, where for 2 years East Timor was essentially a United Nations trusteeship until independence last year. But this is not what the United States has in mind. Basically, what the U.S. is demanding is that the UN provide much of the financial and logistical burdens of the occupation, while the United States is primarily responsible for shaping the military, political, and economic future of the country. And that's a big difference, because UN workers under a trusteeship would be more likely to build cooperative relations with the Iraqi people. As simply part of U.S. occupation, however, they would just become additional targets of an increasingly restive population.
Professor Zunes, what did you think about Secretary General Kofi Annan's response, or his address, rather? You said earlier he was rather subservient. Did he speak as forcefully as he could have?
In theory, he could have. At the same time, as a professional UN bureaucrat who's been around the organization for decades, he recognizes the limits in this geopolitical reality. And he was playing that difficult balancing act between asserting basic principles about the UN Charter, but in the kind of a diplomatic language and demeanor that recognizes that he is there serving at the behest of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, when his predecessor, Boutros Ghali, was a little too blunt in certain areas and defied United States wishes on a number of issues, so he was thrown out of there. So I certainly don't see him as a lackey or anything like that, but I do see him as recognizing the limits, and I wish he would be bolder, but given the circumstances, one can understand why he may hold back. But basically, the things he did say were fairly on target in terms of individual countries do not have the right to take the law into their own hands. And I think this is what this whole issue is about, really. It's not whether the United States should be the world's policeman, but in fact what we're being is the world's vigilante. And that doesn't only raise serious moral and legal questions, but if the United States, with all our power and influence, can't play by the rules, I think a lot of people, including tyrants and terrorists and everyone else, will say, well, why should we?
In his speech, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan seemed to respond to and counter Bush's continuing threats that the UN risked becoming irrelevant. In fact, he said that the United Nations must not shy away from questions about its legitimacy, and he called for major internal reforms in the inner workings of the body, including a restructuring of the Security Council to more fairly and democratically reflect the views of the world community. Professor Boyle, what was your assessment of Kofi Annan's address yesterday?
Kofi Annan is no Dag Hammarskjöld. The United Nations Charter, Chapter 15, makes it clear that the UN Secretariat and the UN Secretary General are one of the independent organs of the United Nations, responsible to the extent they can of promoting international peace and security. And Article 100 makes it very clear that they must not take instructions from any UN member state. From the very beginning of this crisis with Iraq 1 year ago, Kofi Annan incorrectly interpreted that to mean that he would become an errand boy for the United States. And I believe he has brought shame on the role of some of his predecessors. In the speech he gave before the General Assembly, if you read it, he made it appear as if it was the poor United States government that was about to be attacked by someone, and therefore we needed to rewrite the rules of international law.
He did lay out what some have characterized as a fairly sharp, critical, analysis he's given so far of the U.S. policy to act unilaterally.
During the past year of this crisis, when it started with Vice President Cheney's two speeches in August, Kofi Annan did not lift one finger to to oppose the U.S. aggression against Iraq. And he had all the powers under Chapter 15 of the U.N. Charter to do something and try to stop it. I can assure you that Dag Hammarskjöld would have moved heaven and earth to try to stop the aggression against Iraq, which was a U.N. member state. Kofi Annan did nothing. So these are crocodile tears. Yes, of course, this doctrine of preventive warfare is a Nazi doctrine of international law that was rejected soundly by the Nuremberg Tribunal back in 1946. But he did nothing to stop it or to oppose it. And now that Iraq has been vanquished and conquered, he sheds a few crocodile tears up there and says he's against the doctrine.
Gentlemen, where does this leave us in terms of moving forward and the Bush administration's need to acquire international support, both in the way of troops and money, to continue the occupation and the reconstruction of Iraq? What is the next step? Does it look to you like President Bush will get the support he's seeking for internationally or not? And Professor Zunis, I'd like you to respond.
Well, it's possible the United States could get another resolution that invites or even encourages member states to contribute to the U.S.-led occupation. But I don't think many will follow through, frankly, other than the poor third world and Eastern European countries that are in hock to the International Monetary Fund that the United States can essentially bribe into contributing token forces to make it look like a coalition. But in terms of easing the overall burden of occupation, I don't think the U.S. will be successful, which means that the ball is in the court of the American people to demand that the United States end the occupation, turn it over to an authentic international effort of a U.N. trusteeship on the East Timor model, both for the obvious moral and legal reasons, but on the very practical level that the people of Iraq would be far more likely to resist and far more likely to be able to build a stable and democratic society if they are doing so under the auspices of the international community, as opposed to a superpower that has a clear strategic, economic, and political objectives in that region.
Professor Boyle, Professor Zunis says that the ball is now in the court of the American people, and you said earlier that President Bush was really playing to the American people from the UN podium. So do you think that he convinced the American people that he's a strong leader and that that he will therefore increase his standings in the polls here?
Well, that's what he was trying to do. But look, we're at a critical turning point now. General Shinseki indicated in testimony it would take 500,000 U.S. troops to occupy Iraq. And then he was basically de facto fired by Rumsfeld. So they know this has been planned quite some time ago. The fellow who said it would take $200 billion, he was fired too. So they know what they're doing and what their objective is. And their objective, their long-term objective, is to hold on to Iraq whatever it takes. The American people are at a critical turning point here, pretty much like just before Johnson's buildup in Vietnam. Do we want to see a 500,000 troops in Iraq and wasting hundreds of billions of dollars over there that could be better spent on the poor, the oppressed, and the downtrodden people of color here in America? I think that's the issue. What do the American people want done with Iraq? Are we going to go along with Bush and his neocon advisors and stay there forever, have bases, or are we going to pull out, turn this over to a United Nations General Assembly peacekeeping force, set up, as Professor Zunis says, a UN trusteeship, and come home? It's clear Bush wants to stay. They want the oil. And it's now really up to the American people for us to weigh in here. I've launched this national campaign to impeach Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft. It's proceeding to take off. Senator Graham endorsed impeaching Bush. The National Green Party has endorsed it. Just recently, Santa Cruz, California has endorsed it. Arcata, California is about to endorse it. So we really need to get that message through. It's time to get out of Iraq. 58,000 men of my generation were killed in Vietnam because of all the lies told by Johnson, McNamara, Dean Rusk, the Rostow brothers, the Bundy brothers, and everyone else. This is exactly what's going on here today. It's all lies, and the American people, I think, hopefully this time, will not be fooled again.
Gentlemen, thank you both for your time and your perspective. Any final thoughts on your part, Professor Zunes?
Only that I think the Bush administration has really overreached, and it's becoming increasingly apparent to the American public, and this really offers a moment where progressive forces in this country could really expose what the lies and the whole system that made it possible and push for a real reordering of priorities.
Stephen Zunes is an associate professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Also joining our conversation was Francis Boyle, professor and international law expert at the University of Illinois at Champaign. Well, as we approach our one-year anniversary here on Peace Watch, we're digging into our archives all this week and re-airing some of our favorite and most memorable segments. Today, we present this musical reflection from Washington area actor and performance artist Funkus Velvet.
I'm playing today for creative freedom, for dignity, for all life, and world peace. And I want to ask you, how many wars must there be before you realize no man is your enemy? How much blood must spill before your heart begins to fill? 'Cause God knows there's been enough pain, and I'd rather not see tomorrow if tomorrow's going to be the same as it is today. So you can put it to my head and pull the trigger and blow me away. 'Cause I tell you clearly, your tyranny puts no fear in me. So throw down your weapons, for your weapons are useless against me. For I am a creator born free. I am a creator born free. And my mind has passed through the fear of death. And I'm just here watching the breath. For love is so easy to say, only if we followed its way. Only if we followed its way, we wouldn't kill one another. You wouldn't see my color, and our mothers and our sisters would not be raped, and you would not take what did not belong. And we're all still waiting for the light to dawn. How many wars must there be before you realize that no man can be free until all men are free? I can hear a sound in the distance, and it's blowing like a thundering rain. Can you hear it? I can hear a sound in the distance, and it's crashing like a runaway train. Can you feel it? Babylon is falling, and the spirit is calling. And out of this night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I think whatever the gods may be for my unconquerable soul.
the thoughts and music of Washington area actor and performance artist Funkus Velvet. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.